We'll be right back. And when little Jimmy went back home, he did listen to his mummy. And he did listen to his daddy. And little Jimmy did listen to his brothers and his sisters. Sometimes. Little Jimmy listened very carefully to everybody. And then little Jimmy still did whatever he wanted to do. But at least he listened. Little Jimmy, don't close the book. It's not the end.
Unceded airwaves, Amuxin, Luam Godu, will get Goidik Sisim. My name is Lisa Gerbov, Tsimsianu. I am Tsimsian, and my language is the Smalich language. I come from Lough Willams, but I grew up in Prince Rupert in the Tsimshian territory, and I acknowledge that I am an uninvited guest on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people while I study at UBC. N'toyaxin to the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people who are hosting us today on their territory. We have a very special show happening today. We are going to be having our open house episode, and we have coffee here that is provided by Decolonizing Water. So if you're up in the nest, come on down and grab yourself some coffee and listen to some great discussion that we're going to have. But to start off, we're going to get the Indigenous Collective to introduce themselves. I'll start off with Maya.
Hi. My name is Maya, and I am a student in anthropology master's program at UBC, and I am originally from Philadelphia, which is Lenape territory, and I just moved to Vancouver in September for my master's program. And I am a settler on the traditional ancestral and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people, and I am very grateful to be here today.
And my name is Nikita Day. I'm a member of the Tahltan Nation, but I grew up mostly in Smithers, which is on Wet'suwet'en territory, and now I'm a third-year student here at UBC.
And you are listening to Season 2, Episode 22 of Unceded Airwaves, and we are finally doing our open house style show from the CITR lobby in the lower level of the UBC Nest. So come by, check out our show in action as we talk about Indigenous water governance. And as I mentioned, we have some coffee here that Decolonizing Water has provided for us. For our show today, we are partnering with the Decolonizing Water SHRC funded project, that is Social Science and Humanities Research Council. We're partnering with them. They're partnering with the UBC University, and what they're doing is they're creating a prototype of an Indigenous-led community-based water monitoring program that is rooted in Indigenous law, and they're going to be partnering with us today for the broadcast. Decolonizing Water aims to create tools that support Indigenous communities to implement Indigenous laws, and also aims to create suggestions for reforms to colonial water law that would enable it to make room for Indigenous water laws. You can find more info on their website at decolonizingwater.ca. But before we get into it, let's set our intention for the day.
Okay, so we are the Indigenous Radio Collective, and every week we discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. And we're a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use our weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
We strive to center Indigenous voices on our show and to build narratives that empower Indigenous people. Self-representation in media is something that Indigenous people do not often have access to.
This show gives us the opportunity to share and define who we are as Indigenous people, and allows us the opportunity to share a little bit about our culture, as our cultures are incredibly diverse, and that's not always represented in mainstream broadcast media. It can be difficult to find positive Indigenous role models in popular media, so that's what we're doing here, is we're highlighting those influential Indigenous people.
So if you can relate to the goals of the show and are wondering how you can get involved, please reach out to us. You can always reach us on our social media. We have Facebook, Twitter, and if you have a voice for decolonization, then we want to hear from you.
Everyone is welcome, and there is no experience necessary. Our weekly meeting is at Wednesday, 4 p.m. at CITR in the lower level of the Nest. If you want to get involved but don't want to be on air, there are plenty of other ways to participate in this collective. This week, we are playing all Indigenous music.
So you can also follow us on Unceded Airwaves on our Facebook and Twitter page. If you're aware of a great Indigenous artist, feel free to send us a tweet using the hashtag Unceded Music, or you can send us a Facebook message at Unceded Airwaves, and we will do our best to get it on the air. Plus, if we play a song you send us, we will give you a shout-out on the show.
We're always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to, so let us know about any Indigenous artists that you're into right now and what events you're attending or promoting. As always, we'll post a link to the podcast of this episode after the show. We'll have our weekly Unceded events listing to share a little later in the show.
Before we get going, a few shout-outs to those occupying their territories: the Mati Lee of the Gitxsan Territory, the Unist'ot'en of the Wet'suwet'en peoples, those occupying Leelu Island in the Tsimshian Territory, the Tsilhqot'en Nation, who are still battling Taseko mines, the Natchonayak'dun, Trondek'wetchen, Tletlik'wetchen, and Vundink'wetchen peoples fighting to protect the Peel Watershed. And that Supreme Court of Canada hearing is happening this Wednesday, March 22nd. So we're going to play a song here before we get into conversation with Gordon Christie and Willow Thixon about Indigenous water governance. We have Kinney Starr. This single is Save Our Waters. Kinney Starr is Mohawk, and this is going to be our first song of the show. Nikita?
Thank you. faster than them rivers can run. Leaks spring up, tailings come undone, and grandfathers watch the young ones die. Well, water catches flame, water catches flame, water catches flame, my oh my. Hey, hey. Save them for our great-granddaughters. Save them before all is dead and done. Hey, hey.
Song by Kinney Starr that was Save Our Waters. That was a single that we that was suggested to us by Willow Thixon, who is joining us now. Today we are going to be discussing topics that explore Indigenous water governance, water sovereignty, how water really relates to communities. But I'm going to start off by having our guests introduce themselves. So maybe we'll start off with you, Willow.
Tansay, everybody. My name is Willow Thixon, and it would be very confusing if I introduced myself in my traditional language, as there are three of them. So it gets a little bit confusing. I am Anishinaabe, Ojibwe from my mom's side, and Métis, separate distinction. And on my dad's side, I am Cree and Métis and French, although if you've listened to me in other radio shows, I try to less acknowledge the French because I don't really identify personally with being French. It's just there, and people always question me about being mixed. I am currently a first-year medical student here at UBC and graduated with a bachelor's of kinesiology and health sciences. I do a lot of random environmental health work and have family in Treaty 8 that is going to be affected by the Site C Dam, and family in Treaty 6. Grew up in Fort McMurray and on a tiny little reserve, so I am not a stranger to extractive resources and the effect on water.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Gordon Christie. I am a professor at the Peter A. Allard School of Law here at UBC. And I'm originally from Inuvik. My family's Inuvialuit and Inupiat. And then obviously Scott with the last name Christie. And I'm part of the Water Governance Project, so I think I'll probably spend most of my allotted time here talking about that project and how it relates to issues around water and water governance.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for being here with us today. Just a reminder that we have coffee down here at CITR. We're in the lower level of the Nest. It's welcome to anyone. Help yourself. Come on down and check out what's happening here with the show. To start off the discussion, perhaps, since Willow, you're from the Treaty 8 territory, or you grew up there, we can maybe give a bit of, I can give a bit of background on what's happening. This is a place where Indigenous-led water governance is of major importance, as this is where the Site C Hydro Dam Expansion Project is located, as well as many LNG fracking sites. The Prophet River and West Moberly First Nations are arguing that flooding the 5,500 hectares of the Peace River Valley to make way for the Site C Hydroelectric Project infringes on their constitutionally protected treaty rights. The Federal Court of Appeal has dismissed the lawsuit in January and tried to prevent the Site C Dam project, tried to prevent the First Nations from stopping the dam project from going ahead, which I think is kind of crazy, because what had happened was the court ruling said that they weren't actually going to determine whether or not the treaty rights are in fact violated by Site C, but it did determine that the federal government is allowed to issue permits without the duty to discover if treaty rights are in violation, which makes me kind of wonder, like, why sign a treaty at all if one party isn't going to honor their obligations. It kind of boggles the mind. And so First Nations are saying that the federal cabinet should have determined if Site C infringed upon their treaty rights before they went ahead with the project. The feds and BC Hydro are saying that treaty rights should be determined in court. And so it's kind of like a, I don't know if there's a way to win that, especially with the current system that's happening right now. But to start off the conversation, perhaps we can chat about kind of what your ideas are about what would happen if people put protection of water first and foremost as their priority, and maybe how it relates to this project.
We're going to have contests who goes first here, okay? So there are a couple things I could comment on just with what you said about the Site C Dam, but I'll jump into this question here about putting water first. There's a, you know, a something of a battle going on below the surface here between different ways of thinking of water. And, you know, you can just think of water as something important to you and put it first, but on the Indigenous side, it's not necessarily about just thinking of water as having value. It's understanding that water is tied to your existence. It's part of who you are. It's got a relationship to you. So there is a notion of kinship at play in the Indigenous way of thinking about water that I think needs to be somehow incorporated into the Western view of water. Instead of thinking of water as just a thing out there that you can use and you can sell and you can process, there needs to be a way of coming to think of water as a way that is traditionally common across Indigenous communities, and that is thinking of water as not a soulless thing that you can just use, but is actually related to our lives, and it has life of its own.
Yeah, I think that you can't, I'm just going to trampoline off your idea that water is not inanimate in Indigenous cultures and has been recognized as such in places like New Zealand, where it is given its own human rights, I believe, that just passed. I don't know if you guys read that, where it is acknowledged as being something that should be protected because it is a living thing. It is a living thing, and we've acknowledged that in many, I can only speak for myself, but in many traditional practices across Canada, we recognize water as being our mother's earth, our mother's lifeblood. And so you map it like the veins of the earth. And coming from a health background, you think about clogging one of those veins. Okay, well, what's going to happen? You're going to have like an ischemic event. You're going to have no nutrients or no oxygen going to certain areas, and then things are going to die. In health, we refer to that as like some sort of necrosis or some sort of ischemic attack, cause a stroke, whatever. You think about stroke of the land, and you think about what would happen in Site C if you stop the flow of water. So I think that giving protection of water as an actual living thing, because it provides both nutrient sustenance and it's part of our cycle and is a lot of our heartbeat within our traditional territories, it deserves to be recognized as such, I think, in Canada.
I think it's had a word like that's a wonderful way to think of things. And when you think of heartbeats and think of water having a sort of a way of being thought of that way in terms of heartbeats of the earth, There's a heartbeat that takes place over the course of an entire year. There's a very slow, long heartbeat that water is sounding to us. We can hear it. And that's what's being disrupted primarily by things like the Site C Dam. There's a year-long process that would normally happen in an ecosystem in a watershed where water is building up over certain times of the year. It's drying up during other times of the year. And the ecosystems have a way of interacting with that. That's part of their natural existence. And when you dam up a water shed like this, you interrupt that, and it has an effect all the way down the rest of the watershed then, right down the Mackenzie River out to the Beaufort Sea. So there's things to think about that I think are not being put into the forefront of concerns around what's going on with these kinds of projects. And just to let people know, the current government has in their back pocket a plan to dam up dozens of rivers across the northern tier of the country. And so we're just on the edge of a large battle that's going to erupt across all parts of northern Canada as more and more dams are being, you know, put across water and preventing the natural flows, the natural heartbeat that goes on.
Something that I tend to come across whenever I read about things happening to water in the north, if you've never been to the north, you don't understand its vast nutrients. You don't understand its vast beauty. You don't understand how much
product productive land is actually up there. Like I can go and go into a field and there's blueberries for days. And so if you've never been there, you don't really have an appreciation of what's going to be destroyed. And I've been to Moberly Valley, I've been to Moberly River, I've been to all of these places, and the thought of them being destroyed and beautiful lush farmlands is really tragic for me. But to analogize it for something that you can think about in Vancouver, imagine the Fraser River was dammed and then Richmond was flooded and most of New West. So just imagine all that's gone and all the people that were there are actually going to be displaced and all the farmland, because there's a lot of beautiful farmland in Richmond and in that area, it's all going to be gone. Okay, well now what do we live off of? So with our increasing population, we're having a like decrease in farmland, but what we're concerned about is actually our energy. And to me, that's really kind of backwards thinking, because we need that lush farmland. There's not a lot of viable farmland that's that rich in soil resources and natural water in British Columbia. So even if you're thinking not necessarily from an Indigenous decolonial construct of life-giving earth and water and it being the blood of our mother, you can think about it like on a very practical, almost utilitarian viewpoint that our population is increasing at a rapid rate, that we're actually now producing food in ways we never were before, and we're coming to food scarcity. And we're gonna now destroy farmland to create energy when there are alternative measures to do this. It just does not seem intuitive to me, naturally.
And I think what also confuses me is that this project in its current state has been rejected twice before. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, really, what changed to change people's minds the third time?
Christy Clark.
I don't think people's minds changed. I think we have a government that has a very close connection to certain industries. And there's a little thing coming up in a few weeks called an election. People might want to think about that and build some momentum around perhaps change in the political landscape, because there's no real reason for this dam. The more you dig into the project itself and think about the economics of it, think about the ecological devastation, think about, you know, the reasons why you might want to put this in place, there are no clear reasons why. There are many, many reasons why not. And so I think people need to become educated about what is going on behind the scenes with this particular neoliberal government.
And I was looking into the economics of it and whether or not it would be possible to still stop the Site C dam. I mean, it's been in the preparation stages for about 21 months. It's been going on for a while anyhow. And there's been a lot of prep work that's been getting done on the riverbank to get it ready. This is, of course, the biggest project in BC's history. And they've already spent about $2 billion of it, and they're expected to spend $8.8 billion on this particular project. And so, like, is this still economically viable to stop this project? And so when I was looking into it, I found an article by the TAI that said that the former BC Hydro CEO Mark Eelson and Harry Swain, the head of the Joint Federal Provincial Government Review for Site C, both of them are saying that it is still viable to cancel the project.
If I can put a quick plug in, there'll be a short piece coming out in a thing called Policy Options, which is available online in the next couple of weeks. And it lays out the economics plus the Indigenous perspective on the Site C dam. And you can see very concisely the economic side of things. And it's clear we're not at a point of no return. What's happening is this particular government is trying to push it past that point so we can't stop it. The argument, we put so much money into it, we can't stop it. But we're not there yet. And the amount of money that's being wasted in this project, if it goes ahead all the way to completion, is absolutely enormous. And everybody out here listening, we'll all be paying for this. Okay, it's not some sort of, you know, check that's been written and it's just some mysterious party's paying. Taxpayers, people who use electricity, will be the ones paying for the next 30 or 40 years for a project that isn't needed.
I read somewhere, and do not quote me on this because I don't remember where I was reading this, that our BC Hydro bill would be expected to increase by 40% over the next several years. And my hydro bill is already expensive, so I don't really want a 40% increase, and I can't imagine what that does to the shift in people that can't afford hydro. And so you go in the north and people are going 50% hydro, 50% wood burning stoves, 50% hydro, 50% propane tanks, because they can't afford or have no resources. And when you look at, as much as I love a wood-burning stove, there's a bunch of negative health effects and consequences of have wood-burning stoves. And so I'm like, well, what, why? Just why? I have so many questions why. Not to mention the current state. So we put $2.2 million or something into this, and they've just destroyed it, essentially. There's a massive amount of erosion and sediment leakage that's happening on the Moberly River as it stands. And they're seeing high amounts of, heavy metals and toxic chemicals that are actually going to be leaching from this erosion that they're supposed to be putting a stop to. At some point, there's I think it might be an injunction. I'm not a legal speaking person. So something, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is trying to stop them because they're not taking the proper precautions that they should to protect the river and the downstream effects. So there's turbid water, the fish aren't going to be able to see, the fish are going to actually have clogged gills because they can't breathe because the amount of sediment that's in there, not to mention the even further downstream effects from that. So you think about, okay, well now the algae's not going to happen, the salmon have no food, or the fish in the waters have no food. Who eats the fish? You know, the bears. And then who eats the bears? Well, we eat the bears, and the moose eat the, you know, it's like this non-stop bioaccumulation of toxicity that's going to be caused from this erosion. And maybe, you know, I'm speaking in a little bit hyperbolic terms, because you don't see this kind of stuff right away. You see it long term, like grassy narrows. It's not an instant thing that people can really tangibly sink their teeth in unless they see the water and they're like, wow, this water is really brown right now. I don't understand what's happening, or slow moving. And those kind of things bother me a lot.
Especially if you're not there to see it every day. And I find that very frustrating, especially because I'm from Prince Rupert, and there's a lot of issues around the health of the Skeena watershed for us. And so, you know, with warming climate, we have lower fish runs, and every year it just seems to be like the problem is getting worse slowly, but it's not one of those instant things that everyone sees and they can rally around. It's kind of like the slow accumulation of overfishing, and I don't know, it's just all these issues that just slowly accumulate. But I guess moving on, what my next question for you is, what does reconciliation that honors water as life look like? I know that's a big question.
Reconciliation is a big question in and of itself. And then reconciliation that honors water as life. I feel like that's a two-part question. I feel like that's two separate questions, because reconciliation for me is non-tangible. There is no reconciliation to me. There is mitigation of the destruction that has happened. There's no going back in time and saying like, okay, well now we fix this, because there is no fixing this. You can't give me back my language. You can't give me back my ancestors' knowledge. That is gone. There is no reconciliation, I don't see. There are steps you can take to prevent the damage that has happened. And with the water is life, like water has been life in Indigenous people's way of being since time immemorial. And to honor that, similar, I guess, if you wanted to parallel it with the Indigenous people in New Zealand, I think would allow a lot more stewardship to go back to the traditional stewards of the land, so which are traditionally here, the Indigenous people. And that doesn't mean that it's like pan-Indigenous. I'm pretty sure everywhere I've been, we've taken care of the land and the water around us. And where I come from, Anishinaabe people, the women are the water protectors. That's our job. We sing water songs where we take care of the water. And so to give back, part of the reconciliation, if you gave back rights, like, I don't know if you call them human rights at this point, to land and acknowledged it as, I mean, to, not to land, to water, and acknowledged that as a life, then it would allow us to fulfill our traditional duties to manage it and take care of it. But along with that comes a responsibility to our people, and our people are also not all in the best place because of colonization. So the reconciliation, does that have to happen before the power can be given back to the stewards of the land and the life? You know, it's, I don't, that's complicated.
Same problem. There are really two major issues in that one question, and so I'm gonna tackle this by going back to what you're talking about at the beginning, the treaty arguments being made in the last year or so by the Prophet River and West Moberly First Nations. Treaty 8, which is, you know, the area in which a Site C dam sits. This is a treaty that anybody who sensibly looks at things has to understand as being part of what made Canada possible. So everybody listening to this, unless you're a foreign student from some other part of the world, if you're a Canadian, you are a treaty person, because the treaty is an agreement between Canada and you're part of Canada, and those First Nations that opened up this area for sharing, an opportunity for these two groups of people to come to share this land. And it's impossible to not see the treaties that way. That's exactly what they are. And the government tries to, you know, present interpretations that move away from that, but you can't really sensibly move away from that. They open up the land for two different kinds of people to share. Now, what's going on with the Site C is the government is trying to take the treaty and say, well, it gives us the power to take up the land and put in dams if we want to. And they're trying to say that that's happening under the treaty, and so there's no need for arguments to be made about infringement of the treaty. But that's disingenuous, right? That only works at a certain point. When the Canadian side of the equation is opening up land initially, they're taking up land to move in, to share it. But we're far past that point now. You know, there's been so much happening the last 150 years on the land that anytime the government does something now to take up land, it is infringing upon the treaty. It's clear, but they don't want those arguments to be presented at in the courts of Canada, because courts will see that. So that's the point we're at now in 2017. There's this battle to get the treaties understood by all parties the way they were originally understood and the way they have to be understood. And once we get there, we'll begin to make the first few steps on the road to reconciliation. We can't get onto the path of reconciliation if the government continues to see treaties as things they can just play with.
And I think for this question, for myself, the way that I read it is, I first question reconciliation, because did conciliation happen in the first place for us to have reconciliation? And for me, reconciliation, I feel like, should be less on the First Nations. The obligation should not be on the First Nations. It should be on the Canadian state and settlers who have come here and who have taken up that space. And so I think for this, for me, not that anyone asked my opinion, but for me, like, I just see this as being like reconciliation that honors water as life. That just reads to me that it should be like the Canadian state and the province who are taking the initiative to honor water as life and really make meaningful dialogue happen before these kinds of events take place, before we spend $2 billion on a dam that is still being protested. But yeah, moving on, what, I guess to bring this to more of a perspective that we can implement in our everyday lives, what kind of actions can people take to protect water just in our everyday life? Do you have any recommendations?
So there's a lot of things that I do that I'm not saying that you should do to protect water. But I do a lot of protest visiting and a lot of going and seeing watersheds in different territories, because it makes it real for me. Going and seeing the dam, the major dams in the Peace River, made it real for me what the project was going to do. Day-to-day life, I try and use less water. Like, remember in elementary school, they taught us all of these things. Advocate for fresh water. Know what's actually in our water and how they're treating it. I come from Alberta, where we have mass amounts of water treatment plants. We're lucky here in British Columbia, for the most part, we don't have that. But if you've ever been to one of those water treatment plants or seen what happens and how chemically treated your water is and what's actually in it, I know there was a big argument here about fluoride in our water and all of these other questions. Managing, I think, your intake of water is really critical, but it also doesn't solve the larger problems. So get on board, write your MP, go to the rallies, contribute in your community by spreading the word of how this is going to affect the food you eat, how this is going to affect your bills. Everybody has kind of a little weak spot where water is going to affect them. Some people don't care so much about food because they don't maybe eat fresh vegetables. Some people don't care about their money because they have a lot of it. But somebody somewhere has an issue with water because it affects all of us. And so think about that. Maybe rewatch Tank Girl.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, the thing to do on a personal level, obviously, is to educate yourself. Self-education is essential. And once you're involved in that process and you're comfortable with this feeling that you're beginning to get closer to the truth, then you go out and reach the people around you and spread that truth out there, and then they can spread the truth to others. Because we need some sort of process of not relying on the educational system, because as much as I shouldn't speak this way, being a professor here at UBC, the large educational institutions are not really helping that much, because they themselves are tied to this larger game being played by the state to try and, you know, focus all our attention on jobs and the economy, which is really a game being played for a very small number of people to exploit Mother Nature. So we need to, you know, as much as we can, work within the educational systems to turn them around so that they focus on seeing things the right way, but also we can move outside that and do our own work. Educate yourselves and educate people around you.
Also, I forgot to say, vote.
Yeah.
Vote in the election. It's super important. Also, if you want to get involved in some things that are going on campus here, 350.org and EcoHealth through UBC Medicine, we're pushing for divestment here on UBC campus. There was a vote taken a couple years ago. 76% of faculty and students all voted to divest from fossil fuels and any oil and gas. And the Board of Governors said, we're going to ignore your voice and we're going to keep investing in these things to provide things like the Nest or however they want to spin it. I don't think that as a university, we should be investing in things that so many people are against and that are not beneficial to our future. And as students, we have the knowledge, we have the power, it's power in numbers, and we need to stand up and get people on board. So vote and harass UBC.
And just add a word about what's one piece that's missing from the puzzle, and this is something that people here at the university can work on because you're becoming educated in the Western system. We need people to work out how an economic system can function that moves us away from capitalism and neoliberalism. This is one of the big questions out there. You know, there's a sense like there's a vacuum. If we decide that we're going to not invest in these businesses and we're going to move ourselves away from fossil fuels, we need people to be working out the next step. What do we go to from there? So we need people here in the economics programs, in business programs, in law and medicine, everywhere, to be thinking about what's next.
Or if media is your thing, you can get involved with Unseated Airwaves. You can come here and talk about issues that are important to you. I know that's why I got involved with media in the first place, was because I was very passionate about issues and I wanted to have my voice heard. And so that's kind of where I started in broadcasting. And especially for Indigenous people who are interested, like, Indigenous people are already underrepresented in the media, and so to be able to have the skills to actually to appropriate technology to get that message to a broader audience is a great skill to have. And so definitely get involved with Unseated Airwaves. I think we're going to play a commercial, a song here. We have a song that was brought up by Willow again. You should just be our music programmer. This song is Natani Means. This is the song Warrior. It is a single. And Natani Means is an American Indian from Oglala Lakota, Navajo, and Omaha heritage. And so Nikita is going to play us a song.
He's here right now in Vancouver.
Is he here? Is he watching us?
I don't think he's watching this. I think Facebook told me that he's actually downtown, but he's here doing a show tonight. He did a show, if you missed it, it was on Saturday night, and he's doing another one called Voices of Our Water tonight. And it's not really a show, it's more of a talk. He was on the front lines of the No Dapple against the Dakota Access Pipeline. So that's at the Calvary Church. I think it's from 5 till 7.
We have it in our unseated events listings. It's already, it's going to be up on our Facebook and our Twitter pages. So that's happening tonight, and the suggested donation is $15, but no one is going to be turned away for the lack of funds. You can also bring your kids there. There's going to be child care provided for those who need it, and the venue is wheelchair accessible. And so that event is happening tonight, the Wake the World Up Tour. And so this next artist is going to be at the talk. Nikita?
Blood, us men. So that feeling that you have at times when you're angry and you're upset, that goes generations back when we had to fight for our women and our children and our elders.
Right, you heard Natani Means with Warrior on Unceded Airwaves. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Lisa Gerboff, and we are having a discussion today with Willow Thixon and Gordon Christie about Indigenous water governance, and we're focusing more on the Treaty 8 territory, talking about issues of resource extraction, as well as the Site C Dam, which is kind of underway, happening in the Treaty 8 territory. And so To continue our conversation, I just wanted to ask you guys a bit about how BC's planned fossil fuel expansion may affect Indigenous rights. I know it's a really big question.
Okay, so if you don't mind, I'm gonna move us out of the Treaty 8 area for a little bit.
Absolutely.
Because Treaty 8 area is interesting in that you've got these treaties that we talked about in the last hour or so, but in much of the rest of the province, we have no treaties. There are small areas, the Nisga Treaty and some treaties in Vancouver Island and Tawasin have a treaty, but most of BC is unceded territory. And so there, we're looking at a situation where there is no original understanding of how the land's going to be shared, how the water's going to be shared. What that means for anybody, again, who thinks sensibly about these things, is that there's no real basis for Canada imposing its authority over these areas. It just suddenly showed up and just took upon itself this ability to make decisions, but doesn't have any justification for that. So you mentioned you're from Tsimshian territory, and so BC is planning on, you know, putting a large facility in place in your territory to liquefy natural gas. It's going to take a tremendous amount of power to do so, and it's going to be just one stage in a process that's devastating to the environment, because you have to, first of all, frack to get this material that's going to be transported by pipeline across to the coast, and then it gets liquefied and it gets sent over to other markets and gets burned. So the whole process is unacceptable, but it's happening on land where there's no original understanding of the authority of the Crown to do these things. So when you ask about Indigenous rights, we shouldn't focus on the idea that there are rights within Canadian law, because that whole legal system is part of that system that's been imposed upon communities. Indigenous rights properly refers to the law and authority of your community to stand up according to its own understanding of what's legal and what's justifiable, and to say, no, from our perspective, from our law, we decide on what happens in our territory. Canada has to come and ask us about how a relationship might be formed. Until they do that, we're the authority in this area.
And so I guess I have maybe a question, because I don't understand the legal structure that you might be able to answer, is if Canada can go into a treaty place, but the downstream effects are in non-treaty, do they have to address and question all nations, or is it just the treaty nations that they can kind of step on because they have the treaty, and so the treaty allows them the right, but then do they have to ask permission downstream?
Hello, you have been listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This live broadcast is continuing now, and if you would like to hear the entire podcast, you can go to the Unceded Airwaves page on CITR.ca. So this conversation is continuing to be recorded. It's live at CITR in the lounge right now. If you happen to be on the University of British Columbia campus, you're welcome to stop by and watch it live. But the next show, Synchronicity, is up in a moment. So if you'd like to hear the continued conversation, it will be available on podcast at CITR.ca on the Unceded Airwaves page.
I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul.